Good morning and welcome. My name is Raina Wells. I'm Director of Business Affairs and Research at the Ontario Media Development Corporation. And on behalf of OMDC, I'm pleased to welcome you to the second of our four digital dialogue breakfast sessions that are happening in 2014. I'm sure that many of you know OMDC, but for those of you who don't know us, we're an agency of the Government of Ontario, and our mandate is to build Ontario's creative economy through a range of innovative programs and funding for the book and magazine publishing, film and television, music, and interactive digital media industries. We do this through a variety of programs, services, and tax credits, and by organizing events like this one. At these breakfast sessions, we explore topics that we think are of interest across the media industries, and it's our hope that today's session will inspire some new ideas, let you meet some new people, and stimulate some exciting discussion. This morning's session is selling to international markets. One of the challenges for Ontario media companies and content creators is that the Canadian market is simply too small for a company to succeed without selling to markets outside Canada. That's just a reality of our country. So we've asked each of our three panelists to tell us about their experience doing just that, what's worked, and also some of the lessons that they've learned. Thank you to all the panelists for making the time to be here and for all the time you've put into preparing. We really appreciate it. Your moderator this morning is my colleague at OMDC, Kim Gibson. Kim's title is Program Consultant, Interactive Digital Media Industry. And I'm sure that those of you from the IDM industry know Kim very well. Kim is responsible in her role at OMDC for the conception and management of initiatives that contribute to the growth and development of the interactive digital media industry in Ontario. She's been involved in the design and the operation of a number of OMDC programs, most recently the OMDC Export Fund and the OMDC Interactive Digital Media Fund. Please join me in welcoming Kim Gibson and our three panelists, Peter Wilmshurst, Ryan St. Peters, and Rob Siegel.
Thanks, Raina, and thank you, everyone, for joining us this morning. I understand there were a few snafus on the TTC, so for those of you who made it in, bravo. When Raina first asked me to moderate this panel, I originally thought that I wanted to run away in fear because the idea of speaking about international markets with a group of very diverse individuals representing a variety of different industries, I thought, oh my gosh, this is going to be an absolute disaster. But I have to say it's been a real pleasure getting ready for this panel and speaking with the panelists. I had the opportunity to learn a lot about the different business models and approaches that other industries deal with. My area of expertise is the interactive digital media space. I don't know a lot about how magazines conduct business globally. I know a little bit about how things work in the film and TV space. So it was a really informative opportunity for me, and I hope it will be for you guys as well. So while there are definitely differences in the way people and the way industries approach international markets, there are also some common elements and some similarities. So we'll talk about both of those things today. Before we get into the meat of the content, I want to get a sense of who is in the room for myself and also for the panelists. So if I could get you guys to self-identify by raising your hand, I'm going to go through the different industry groups that the OMDC covers. So who is here from the film industry? Who would identify as a film? Okay, great. TV. Good. And do we have some music people in the room? Okay, pretty much even so far. How about books? A couple book people too. And do we have any folks from the magazine space? And how about interactive digital media? Oh, lots of interactive people here today. Great. So it looks like we're pretty evenly distributed, which is good to see. And I have a question for the folks who didn't put up their hand. Why are you here? Just kidding. multiple sectors, yes. Good idea. So maybe forcing you to self-identify into one sector can be challenging at times, for sure. So the format of our discussion today, each of the panelists is going to give a short presentation on their particular approach to international markets. We will have a brief discussion after the presentations, facilitated discussion. I have a couple questions that I would like to ask. And then we'll leave about 15 minutes at the end for questions and answers. I hope you guys all have brought your inquisitive minds and are prepared to challenge these folks with some interesting questions. So without further ado, let me introduce our panelists today. So to my immediate left is Peter Wilmshurst. He's a publisher at AGW Publishing, and that is the company that publishes the magazine Allergic Living. Peter has held senior positions in the Canadian marketing and advertising community, as well as being the publisher of a leading financial services magazine. Allergic Living magazine was launched in Canada in 2005, and then very recently in 2011, they have launched a U.S. version. And then we have Ryan St. Peters to his immediate left. Ryan is the Vice President of Sales and Business Development at Shaftesbury and Smoke Bomb. Ryan joined the company in 2005 and works in global marketing and distribution of Shaftesbury and Smoke Bomb Productions. Before joining Shaftesbury, Ryan was a marketing manager at Pearson, a multinational educational company. And then on the far side of the table, we have Rob Siegel. Rob is one of the co-founders of Get Set Games, the developers of the fast-paced action arcade, games for mobile devices, including Mega Jump and Mega Run. They have over 50 million downloads combined across iOS and Android platforms. And Rob has been working to bring Get Set Games' popular catalog of mobile games to the Chinese market. And he's been working specifically with the Chinese publisher Yoda One. He's continuing to explore the burgeoning Japanese and Korean markets as well. So with that said, I'm going to ask Peter to give a short presentation on his experience in the international market. Peter.
Thank you. We are a single title publisher. We just do one magazine, and it's a magazine that deals with the area of allergies, which is not necessarily an area that all of you would be familiar with, but just to give you a sense of it, food allergies, most of you sort of have heard the peanut thing over and over again. There are obviously other allergens as well. That's probably the highest profile one. We do stuff in the environmental area, which includes asthma. Also includes more common things like pollen, that type of thing. And we also, for good measure, have thrown in one non-allergy area, which is celiac disease, which is gluten-free. And that's very much ad-driven to throw that into the mix, although there is some interaction between the various areas. We launched in 2005. We are Canadian. But from inception, we knew that there was a very high probability that we would go into the U.S. market. And I guess the thinking on our part was to try to get the bugs out a little bit here, make our mistakes, try to get it sort of nailed down, and then move forward. And our plan had actually been to go after a couple of years into the U.S. market. We found ourselves sort of sitting looking at that subprime situation in 2009 saying, just don't want to do it right now. It's just the economy just isn't good enough, which delayed us a little bit. But by 2011, we were sort of full bore. The unique thing with our business is we're very small. We don't play at the same level that some of the Rogers publications would play, sort of the Chatelaines of the world. So it becomes more important for us to really be at the core of our community and almost speak for the community. Our credibility comes from our content. And the people we know and the things that we do and the causes that we advocate, as opposed to just putting a million copies out there, which would be lovely. I would love to be able to do that, but we can't. Our move to the U.S. is very much the way Raina described it, and that's Canada's just, frankly, too small a market for us. I mean, we really needed to get into a bigger playing field. From our standpoint, being at the center of the community, it would have been almost impossible to accomplish that, to take a Canadian publication and just simply export it and drop it into the U.S. market. So we really very much needed to identify a way of actually doing a separate magazine that was very much U.S. and had a U.S. voice and it had U.S. content. We had a bit of an advantage going in that we had built a lot of relationships when we were working here in Canada. We had been working with specialists in the U.S., some of the top doctors. We had been working with support groups. people that were sort of leaders in the community, and we found ourselves in a situation where we had an awful lot of friends before we ever decided to cross the border. We actually were helped out by OMDC, which was wonderful, and thank you again for that when we did our launch, because I'm sure it must have looked like a precarious venture heading into the U.S., but one of the things that we did when we talked to OMDC about it is we put some of these people on the table, and I think it was interesting for them to see the size of the network that we had built before we ever jumped into the U.S. U.S. was obviously a huge opportunity in terms of size, but it became a sort of a huge challenge as well, because if we were small in Canada, we were really small in the U.S. And from that was the sort of the opportunity and the hurdle. It was sort of a double-edged sword for us. We had to put a series of strategies in place to try to counter that. One was obviously we had to try to become the voice of the community down there, but there were other things that we needed to do as well. Credibility-wise, we got a lot of our credibility from the fact that we established strategic partnerships with three of the largest allergy organizations in the U.S. And these are sort of unique partnerships. They're not dealing with any other media vehicles. So right from the get-go, we inherited a lot of their strength, and it was sizable. It was the leading food allergy group in the U.S., the leading asthma group in the U.S., and the leading celiac group in the U.S., and we managed to establish partnerships with all of them, which was really a wonderful thing. The other hurdle we had, obviously, is how to take a very small publication and make it meaningful in a market of sort of 3.5 million people. And in our market, we have 60 million people in the U.S. I mean, we publish 50,000 copies an issue. So you can imagine, how do you appear to be of value to advertisers and of the community generally? And part of that obviously came from the relationships that we've got. The other thing we did is we expanded our reach by setting up a distribution program where the magazine is carried almost exclusively in doctors' offices. And we're in the top 30,000 doctors' offices in the U.S. from an allergy standpoint, sitting in their waiting rooms. So that really gives us an opportunity to extend the readership of the magazine in a way that makes us sort of more interesting. I started thinking back in terms of, like, what type of lessons could we end up sharing with this group, knowing that it's sort of a cross-media group dealing with film and other areas. And I guess the suggestions that I would have, or some of the things that we sort of learned, was that you can't have enough friends on the ground in the market where you're going into to operate. We naturally took a look right from the get-go at sort of what other magazines had done the transition, and the answer is virtually none. So we were really entering into sort of new territory from that standpoint. We didn't know how well we would be accepted down there as Canadians, and happily the answer is we were treated absolutely just as if we were another American company. We were sort of judged on our own merits. Fantastic. I mean, that was all we could have asked for to begin with. The friends down there were certainly a big factor in putting strategies in place. We also tried as much as possible in the market that we were in to really get a sense that we were an American publication. And we've been pretty, it's been interesting. We've had U.S. Olympians on the cover. We have an issue coming up with last year's MVP in the NFL on the cover, who has actually got a connection to our industry. So, I mean, those things certainly helped a little bit. We've done an article on what we refer to as allergy superheroes in the U.S., and it's quite folksy in a sense. I mean, we've gone right down to, you know, bus drivers in Tennessee that are looking out for allergic kids, and, you know, a cafeteria mom that volunteers to make sure that foods are okay for people in allergies. So we've done an awful lot of that type of stuff as well. Social media has been enormous for us. We're not as big as we would like to be. We're about 30,000 on Facebook right now, but we seem to have the ear of this particular community. You may have remembered a situation a few weeks ago that an American Idol contestant actually talked about pranking one of the other contestants, saying that I smear peanut butter on their clothing when they're not looking, which was a horrid thing to say, and it kind of ill-advised. We called the person out online. Interestingly enough, the next show, the person ended up apologizing on air. We had 10,000 people on our site that night looking at the article, which was pretty amazing stuff. I guess in terms of, I mean, that would be a bit of an overview, and we'll get into more specifics, I think, when we talk about questions. But it's funny, I had a friend, this is really almost unrelated to our specific business, but not bad advice from an international standpoint. A good friend of mine has been doing business worldwide for many years, and I asked him before we launched, and I said, what are the things that you would suggest that we do or be conscious of? And he said, the first thing is, if you're going to spend your life in the air, make sure you're in good shape, because you're so subject to illness and sickness and stuff, which was an interesting comment. The first year we were in the U.S., I think I went to New York 22 times. I was in Chicago, I think, 11 times. I mean, I was in L.A. half a dozen times. I did live in the air, and it's not a bad piece of advice. The other one, which was, I think, an even better piece of advice, is he said, check your politics at the door. And that's absolutely a good piece of advice. So we don't talk very much about things like healthcare or other things like that. That's not the kind of discussion we want to engage in. So anyway, that would be a start.
Excellent. Thank you.
So I think before I sort of get into the experience of selling internationally, I'll give you guys a little bit of a background on Shaftesbury and Smoke Bomb. Shaftesbury is one of the largest and most established scripted television and feature film producers in Canada. Smoke Bomb is our digital media company that we acquired probably 6 or 7 years ago now. And Smoke Bomb's remit is twofold. They develop and produce content for, I mean, we say they're platform agnostic. It includes television, a little bit of a different flavor from what's coming out of the Shaftesbury side. But they're also developing original content for online, tablet, smartphone. And I represent both companies internationally, so I will take the projects that we produce and take them out to broadcasters and platforms outside of Canada. So that's what I do on the sales side. On the business development side, it's a little bit more focused on the digital space, and I think I'll clarify digital in a little bit. It's a big word and means a lot of different things to different people. But I'm really focused on establishing sort of output deals in the digital space, because producing content for digital is a different beast from television, where you'll set up a show at a broadcaster, develop that show, produce that show for a broadcaster on the TV side. On the digital side, when you're looking at platforms like YouTube and Blip and those kinds of things, it's a completely different environment. So I'm focused on establishing sort of output relationships there on the digital side. So that's, you know, what I do in a nutshell on the sales side, but I think, or the outward-facing side of what I do, I think sort of the inward-facing side and in terms of Shaftesbury and Smoke Bomb, what I do is it's a lot of market intelligence. So staying on top of what's happening internationally, what broadcasters and other platforms are doing, and bringing that intelligence back into the office in Toronto. We also have a development office in Los Angeles. And using what we know, what Canadian broadcasters and platforms are looking for and what the international marketplace is looking for, and then trying to combine all that and hopefully end up with the hit show or hit property on your hands. It's been referenced a couple of times already this morning how the Canadian market is quite small. It's an interesting place to be when you're a Canadian TV producer, because there's a lot of boxes you need to tick in order to produce television for Canadian broadcasters in terms of reflecting Canadian stories and Canadian experiences. And it's a fine line so that you can tick all those boxes for the partners that you're working for in Canada, but making sure that you have a property that's going to travel internationally. So on the TV side, I think it really just comes down to understanding the content that you're selling and the audience that you're trying to get it in front of. We all know that content is king. And you know, I think the most important thing is that your content is relevant to the audience that you're trying to get it in front of. That relevance can come from a variety of different, you can tackle it a variety of different ways. You know, shortly after that Malaysian Airlines plane went missing, there was 3 or 4 documentary producers in, I think, the UK specifically, that 2 or 3 days later are on top of that and producing a doc about the information that that we have right now on that plane and where it's been. But anyway, that's just in terms of relevance, pinpointing something that's very timely and something that is universal. You can also tackle that relevance, you know, from a genre perspective. There are various audiences that you will find worldwide, like the sci-fi audience. There are pockets of and very healthy pockets of sci-fi lovers all over Europe and Middle East and Southeast Asia. So you can tackle it from a genre perspective, and then you can also tackle it through the content itself. I guess a specific example for us is we produce a show for CBC called The Murdoch Mysteries. And very early days in season 1 on that show, Although the show is not a official Canada-UK co-production, we brought UK TV on board, which is a fairly big conventional broadcaster in the UK. And in an effort to make this show a little bit more relevant to their audience, we cast an actor named Thomas Craig, who had a very long-running role on Coronation Street and has a pretty solid following in the UK. And that was, you know, one effort that we could make in order to make our content a little bit more relevant to that audience in the UK, as we were partnering with the UK broadcaster in an effort to help finance the show. In terms of audience, you know, I sell to acquisitions executives at broadcasters, so those buyers are my conduit to the audience. And you just have to stay on top of what's working for networks and why. You have to understand, and this can be very territory dependent, how people are consuming content, especially in TV when people are jumping from traditional television to iPad to watching stuff online and any combination thereof. And having your production model be a little bit more malleable so that it can fit these ever-changing consumption patterns of audiences. You know, broadcasters, if they do their job well, they can define their brands very easily. You know, we all know what to expect from a Bravo show. Bravo, I'm talking about in the US, or what we can expect from City TV in Canada in terms of the type of content as a broadcaster. But that said, you know, a lot of broadcasters will evolve their models. They will sort of dip in and out of trends, and you've just got to stay on top of that and make sure that your storytelling can reflect those trends. You know, I think a perfect example of that is the Food Network, both here in Canada and in the US. They both started out as almost exclusively their grids were instructional cooking series, stuff like the Barefoot Contessa or, you know, shows from Giada De Laurentiis. And now if you look on their grids, it's almost exclusively shiny floor competition series and what they're calling food adjacent programming. So it has nothing to do with standing there and learning how to bake cookies or whatever. It's just obviously the programming is still very much focused on food, but it's not just about how to make food. It's, as they call it now, food adjacent. So in terms of having, I think, some success in international and TV, those are the kinds of things you need to be sort of on top of at all times. In the digital space, I think there's two things I want to say about that. Digital, or more specifically social media, as it pertains to TV and selling TV, social media has provided content creators with direct access to your audiences, which we never had before. So, you know, if you're looking back 10, 15 years before Facebook and Instagram and Twitter, it was difficult as a content producer to be able to engage directly with the audience. And we have very, very active and engaged fan communities with our shows like The Listener and Murdoch that, you know, provide us with a lot of intelligence and provides us with a direct means of communication to the people that we're actually making programming for. But in terms of taking sort of short form digital programming, web series, that kind of thing to the international market, I think the word international gets a little bit gray and fuzzy when you're talking about digital because you're not selling to individual broadcasters or platforms in individual territories. If you're working with a platform like Blip or like YouTube, these are global in nature, so you're not just catering to specific territories and specific audiences, and I think your storytelling needs to reflect that in an effort to help find your audience and in an effort to help seed your audience prior to production. So I think that's about it. It's what I try to do on a daily basis anyway.
Great, thank you so much. Rob, did you want to give us a brief overview of the international market as Gets It Game sees it?
Yeah, sure. So,
awesome.
So just to give a bit more background of my roles and responsibility, of obviously a co-founder can be kind of catch-all. And we are a small company at Gets It Games, and we only have about 10 people on staff, although we do utilize contractors as well when it's necessary. I'm still very much doing a production role. I'm still involved in the production of many of our titles. But as well as that, you know, we need, as a founder, you need to be concerned about the bottom line. Are we generating enough revenue? And what are the latest opportunities that that we should be taking advantage of? So the Asian markets, specifically China, is something that I've been looking at. And there's definitely been a lots of opportunity there. I was kind of thinking when you were talking, Ryan, how and we've kind of reiterated as well with Peter how Canada is not big enough. I am going to give Canada some credit, at least for in our space. It's actually one of the top spenders for our titles. When you compare it to our initial investment in the Asian markets, where we would launch our titles and just kind of put it out there without any kind of localization. China was not spending a lot of money, hence why we were looking for a publisher in those markets. Canada ranked pretty high, so it was definitely give yourself some support, or thanks for supporting me anyways. We design our games, we don't design them with a specific market in mind. Our approach to game design is generally we will make games that we enjoy playing and that we think people will find fun. And if you've seen our characters, which actually is our protagonist, Redford, is on the OMDC banner. You may have seen him coming in. We try to make things that are very non-specific to any particular culture or region of the world. You know, that obviously we're not familiar with every culture in the world, so I'm sure in certain parts of the world our character could be very offensive. But that's part of the appeal of working with a publisher, and why we wanted to seek someone out and work with them, as opposed to figuring out the nuances of every particular country in the world. There's just not time for that. And again, being a small company, we were really looking for people who could take our products and just run with it. Kind of like, here's our game, here's our title. Adapt it to what you think is good for that market. And for a number of years, that actually, it was not an easy sell. And it's not something we were actively going out and selling to different countries and different publishers in different markets. But what we've seen in the past couple of years is there's actually a lot of companies in China who have been, their business model has been to approach Western developers to bring Western games to the Chinese market or to the Asian markets. So Yoda One, as Kim had mentioned, is the one that we're working with, but there's numerous other ones. Just to name a few, you can check out Chorus Worldwide is a new one that I just heard about yesterday. Saw a press release for them. I Dream Sky, The Nine, and Spellgun. And some of these publishers do have offices in the U.S. or Canada, which can help. Especially when you get down to the legalities of it. That's often the big concern. And we did work through a few different publishers. Working through those legalities, we were talking to a few publishers before Yoda One, and we would say, we have this concern about the terms in the contract, and it didn't. We weren't able to resolve the differences there, and it became very awkward. And then when we got to Yoda One, it was actually a much simpler process. All of our concerns, they said, yeah, no problem. We just want to see if, get the deal done and, put a deal together. And if it's successful, then, we'll keep it in place. And if not, then, we'll go separate ways. So it's the differentiator in this case for us was finding a publisher that was willing to work with our terms, really, and was not afraid to work with us in that respect, and just get things moving, as opposed to getting bogged down in legalities of things. Just to give a bit of a background, more of some, at least one stat that I always think is really remarkable when it comes to the Asian market, and we're not there yet, but because again, our games are only available and localized in the Chinese market right now. But in Japan, if you're familiar with the mobile game space, there's a Japanese company called Gung Ho, which makes a game called Puzzles and Dragons, which if you've seen any of the games in the mobile space, well, you'll know that game. And the last statistic that they put out, which was a couple months ago, because they're I believe they are a public company, or at least they publish their sales stats every so often. They were generating $6 million a day in revenue from just that one game. And it's, you see those numbers and it's just, it's like, how do we get here? Because it just doesn't compare to anything you'll see in the US and in Canada. And that has changed quite a bit over time, where the US was the number one spender for us for a long time. It was essentially the US and the rest of the world for all of our games. And that's changing. Last year, actually, Japan overtook the US in terms of spending per person in mobile titles. That's for the first time ever. So it's pretty remarkable to see how Asia is growing and to watch these trends. And it's markets that you just can't ignore. So we're just going to try to continue to do that. That's it. Great.
Thanks, Rob. So Asia is obviously a priority for you guys. When I had initially asked you, Rob, to participate on this panel, it was interesting to hear your perspective, because when I said, oh, we're going to be talking about international markets, you'd automatically gravitated to, oh, yeah, the Chinese market. We can talk about the Chinese market. I was actually surprised that you didn't bring up the U.S. market at all. Do you consider that an international market?
Yeah, absolutely. It is kind of synonymous with Canada. I mean, often for us, Canada is like a subset of the U.S. in terms of activity and spending. It is still very key, absolutely.
It's a big market for you.
Yeah,
I just found it interesting because I know that you guys have had a fair amount of success there. And looking, and we've talked about a little bit about your experience, and we'll talk about it hopefully if we have a time to get to that question around localization of your content for the Chinese market, because it's something that I find are rather interesting. But I'm assuming in the U.S. market, there really isn't a lot of adaptation that you have to do for that for the games that you release there.
Yeah. Obviously, that's a big plus. I mean, we don't have to translate any text, and basically, all the content is like one to one. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. When we were talking before the panel, I had asked you a couple of questions about your strategy in the U.S. market with respect to content, and I didn't realize that until we'd had this conversation, but I had automatically sort of assumed that you would largely have the same content in your U.S. publication as you do in the Canadian publication, and that actually isn't the case. Can you speak to that for a little bit?
I would say 50% of our content is unique to the U.S. or unique to the Canadian publication, so in a given issue, we might have 60 editorial pages. I would say 30 of them might be shared. And the ones that are shared might be things like recipes. But, I mean, when you get into actual editorial content per se, we really have unique content for each market. That includes the specialists, but it also includes sort of the stories that we end up telling as well. I mean, the stories that involve mothers and children and stuff, I mean, American families. When you're talking educators and things that they're doing, legislation that's happening, all those things are unique to the country in which we end up doing it. And I guess, if you want to be in a position where you almost speak on behalf of the community, and we do to a degree in both markets, I think it's really important that you really understand the issues and the sensitivities of the individual market. I don't think we could take a Canadian publication and drop it into the U.S. I'm not sure whether the reverse is possible or not. I think possibly as Canadians, we're going to be a little bit more conditioned to having U.S. products sort of put in front of us. Certainly that's not the case in reverse. So we felt it was pretty important to actually have a sort of a legitimate American voice in terms of the magazine. And it's very much that way, especially with doctors and specialists and that type of thing.
Okay. Obviously, the international market is a big concern or a growing concern for your companies. Can you guys share a bit of information on sort of the breakdown of revenues and any sort of trends you see with respect to your individual companies? So maybe we can start with you, Peter.
Sure. We haven't been at it that long yet. I mean, we launched only in 2011. The U.S. is roughly 3/4 of our business now after a matter of a few years, which I think is still it's still undeveloped in terms of the amount of potential. I know that when we launched in Canada, I felt like by the time we got to year three, I felt like I'd talked to every advertiser in the country, and I probably had. We're 3 years in the U.S. right now, and I don't feel like I've scratched the surface. I mean, it's just an endless amount of people that you could end up sort of approaching, which is a wonderful thing, frankly, when you come down to it. So, I mean, if anything, I would say Canada is overdeveloped. We've got a real strong foothold here. I mean, we are Canadian. We know this market inside out and have a pretty strong basis. But the opportunity in the U.S. is, I mean, it's so enormous. I mean, we're talking people with really serious allergies, which is our bread and butter. You're talking maybe 3 million people in Canada. You're talking close to 30 million in the U.S., which is interesting. So, I mean, it gives you a size of the relative audience that you've got that you end up reaching. And the advertiser thing is just, it's through the roof in terms of companies that are potential to be involved with us.
I think for us, I mean, shows are produced and made here in Canada, and then I take them to international. So international is 100% of what I do. The U.S., I mean, I think arguably the U.S. is the biggest market for probably one of the biggest markets for all of the industries that are up here on this panel. It certainly is for us, but it's tricky to build a sustainable TV business as a Canadian producer if you're 100% focused on the U.S. market. You know, we have two of our sort of flagship dramas, the Murdoch Mysteries and The Listener, that we produce for CTV. Those are long-running series. Right now we're in the midst of the fifth season of The Listener and the eighth season of Murdoch. Both of those shows just recently got U.S. pickups, and they have, you know, sustained themselves through Canadian investment and international success from the very beginning. You know, I mentioned that we try to craft our stories, obviously, that they're going to resonate with Canadians, but will also do well internationally. It all depends on the genre. We do a lot of kids programming. We produce a lot of kids live action for, you know, networks like Family Channel. And when I'm looking at, you know, stuff like that, my biggest market is Western Europe and then some English-speaking territories like South Africa and Australia. Kids live action does not resonate in Southeast Asia, mostly because the broadcasters that will be acquiring that content are pan-regionals like Disney and Nickelodeon that sort of broadcast throughout the Southeast Asian footprint, and they need to localize those. We talked a little bit about localization, and when you're dealing in kids' TV, you know, a lot of kids in that part of the world, their first language is not English. So a broadcaster is looking at actually dubbing a show into 15, 17 different languages, and the costs, the dollars just don't add up. So I think it's very dependent on the type of content you're looking to sell, I think. But, you know, if I was to characterize it, most of my business is focused in Western Europe.
Okay. And Rob, can you give us a bit of a breakdown? I know the Asian markets are new to you guys, but obviously you've already mentioned Canada's the big one for you.
Yeah, it does tend to be very volatile in terms of the trends that we see. So it's a lot of the spikes in activity for either like spending or people playing tend to revolve around holidays because, of course, that's when kids are home playing their parents' phones or on their own devices playing games. We definitely got some spikes there. It's been interesting going into the Asian markets for holidays that we're just not familiar with, like Chinese New Year, which was the end of January this year, and that's seen a big spike in activity, and our publisher keeps telling us, you know, we really need to focus on getting some new content or updates for Chinese New Year because it's As they put it, it's basically like Christmas in China in terms of activity. And there's a lot more people, obviously. But there is, in the North American or Western markets, which are big for us, so U.S., of course, is big. And then Germany and France tend to be quite active for us in Europe. You'll see a lot of spending and activity around the holidays because people are getting their new devices, new phones, as well as when Apple or other big manufacturers launch a new device, we'll see a spike in activity around then.
Okay. I think we're at about the period, according to the flag that I've gotten from my colleague Rain at the back, that we've got some time for some audience questions. I've got a whole slew of questions if you guys don't have any, because I have about 15 on my page. But I'm going to give you guys an opportunity to ask some questions. So do we have any questions from the audience? in the back. You were quick on the draw. Sorry, I'm just going to get you to hold on until we get you a mic.
David Valkin. I'm actually in the film TV area, but I'm fascinated by the periodical sector. And Peter, you said that 30,000 of your 50,000 subscribers really go to doctor's offices, and therefore the paper product is quite important. But I'm wondering what you think about tablet-based magazines, and if that's a way of expanding your reach into the ordinary home and the consumer market. As well, do you segment a Canadian and American website so it's customized, or do you just have the single website for both publications?
Well, I'm thinking where I'll start. The website maybe is a little bit easier. Some of our major advertisers in the U.S. markets want us to geo-block, so we felt that it was important to actually set up separate websites. And also from a selling standpoint, a lot of people are really only interested in traffic that's originating out of their own country, which is why we did the split between the two. I'd prefer almost in some ways to have it as one, because the numbers are a lot bigger and it would look a lot better from a selling standpoint. But no, we made that split about the start of the year, and the content actually is different in some situations. You asked about tablet applications from a magazine standpoint. Part of our business model is paid subscribers. I'm still wrestling with how digital magazines work from an economic standpoint, and Matt's smiling at me here because he and I have this discussion regularly, but to give the magazine away, to me, doesn't make an awful lot of sense. Now, I guess you could sit back and say, if you can get a larger audience, can't you capitalize from a financial standpoint by selling digital publications? The track record is still not good, to my knowledge, in terms of digital publications and the ability to sell ads digitally. I deal with probably every major U.S. ad agency there is with the client base that we have got. I don't think I've ever seen an RFP that says anything other than, do you have a tablet application with an asterisk beside it saying we don't pay for digital ads? We'll take them as value added. So from that standpoint, I have to sit back and say, why do I want to put the magazine up online? I know an awful lot of people are doing it. The next issue phenomena that's going on right now is a source of real confusion to me personally. I don't know how this thing works. I really don't. It's been in place in the U.S. since 2009, and yet I've yet to see it compete with me for any sort of ad dollars where people say, well, this is an alternative, so what have you got that can counter it type of thing, or what do you do digitally? It never even comes up in conversation. I don't know whether that's answered any questions or not.
Great. So we've got one right here.
It's another question for Peter.
Can I just get you to state your name?
Yep, Melanie Ward.
Thank you.
I'm in the magazine industry.
Thank you.
Just before, as you were preparing to enter the U.S. market, did you, because in the healthcare sector, there's so many magazines that are published by associations.
Yep.
And yet you partnered with many associations. So were there association titles you were competing with, or do you position yourself as more of a consumer book?
We are a consumer book. We're definitely a patient magazine, but we're a patient magazine that's sort of grounded in the medical community, if you know what I mean. We try to take medical information and present it in a way that's very consumer friendly. There's also an awful lot of lifestyle stuff in the magazine as well. It would be pretty dry if it was just medical, but I mean, if a new study came out, we would probably interpret it from people's standpoint and try to get it out of the doctor speak type of phenomena into something that a mom with kids at home can sort of understand. There were no association publications in our area. We actually walked into a clean piece of paper in terms of nobody really doing anything. There was a bit of stuff in the asthma area. There was nothing certainly in the food allergy area. It wouldn't have bothered us if there was, because I mean the size of any sort of health-oriented publications in our area are so small. If there were three of them, probably advertisers should be using all three of them, if you know what I mean. That's certainly the case in the gluten-free arena. I mean, there are, I think, four publications doing gluten-free in North America right now, and the four of us added up together in terms of physical copies might hit 250,000. It's just a drop in the bucket. In some ways, other magazines that were similar might actually end up help doing some of the missionary work in terms of convincing new advertisers to enter the marketplace. There's one thing I forgot to mention that in the last time out that is worth mentioning, though, and that's that when you talk about lessons learned, what we've learned is after even the few years that we've got, and this is kind of a happy accident that has sort of happened, but I would say roughly half our Canadian ad base right now came from U.S. advertisers that didn't know what the heck to do up here in Canada. And I'm almost throwing it into sales pitches as an afterthought right now, and I'm saying, do you have an operation in Canada? And they're saying, yes, we do. And I say, do you do any advertising in Canada? And they say, we wouldn't have the foggiest idea where to start. And it's interesting, but we have picked up a lot of Canadian business through the back door, through our U.S. operation, which is something we never anticipated, but it's certainly been a nice thing to have happen.
So we've got a mic at the back, Emmanuel, and then.
Just a question. You mentioned, I think Brian, Robert, and Peter, you've all mentioned some of the costs associating with selling internationally, whether it's translation costs or localization costs. When you're dealing with a publisher or a distributor or a buyer, can you talk about some of the specifics and how that cost is shared? Do they contribute to it? Or does it sometimes just even make sense for you guys to do the localization or the translation and then sell it as a packaged, completed product to international markets?
I think for us on the TV side, it depends on the show. It depends on who you're selling it to. Oftentimes, if you're looking at like a big budget, 1 hour scripted drama, and if you're selling it to a big conventional broadcaster, they will pay a license fee in order to broadcast that show, and they will often handle the localization themselves. In the kids' space, it's entirely different. More oftentimes than not, as the distributor, I'm responsible for providing the broadcaster with a version that's already been localized. So I have to be able to ensure that, depending on how many windows I'm going to execute in a given territory, that I'm going to be able to, A, pay for this version and make a little bit of money on top of that. So if you're looking at a TV series, again, it's all show dependent, but you might be able to get a limited pay TV window and followed by a slightly more expanded free TV window, and then you'll go into like OTT services like Netflix and that kind of thing. So over time and through a variety of windows, you can make sure that you stay on top of that and make a little bit of money in the end. So it depends on the genre and who you're selling to, but it is it's absolutely crucial, obviously, and it can be very cost prohibitive, especially in some of the big European territories that have a lot of money to spend. You're also dealing with actors' unions and that kind of stuff in those territories. That the voice actors, it's quite costly to do a half-hour French version for a kids' show in France. It's a fraction of the cost to produce a neutral Spanish version and a Brazilian Portuguese version in order to service the market in Latin America. So sort of it depends on where you're selling to and who you're selling to.
And Rob, do you want to take that question?
Yeah, sure. I guess for our stuff, it's generally whoever we're working with, and in the case of Yodel One, it certainly validates this in China, in that they basically need to do the translation for us. We just don't have the time to do that work, and wouldn't have the time, really. All this stuff that we do outside of North America tends to pull us away from making the games themselves, because it is kind of a new market for us. So whenever we explore any new country or new region, the partner we're working with really needs to take on a lot of the responsibility, because otherwise that time is not spent making games ourselves, which is what we want to be doing.
And just, we've talked a little bit about translation. Are there other kind of adaptations that you have made to the game that to make it more suitable to the Chinese market?
Yeah.
Because this is something I actually find really fascinating.
Yeah, there's... Much more past like translating the text. We have been advised by Yodel One, and certainly other games have kind of validated this. Yodel One has another partner they work with called Defiant. They make a game called Ski Safari, which is pretty big in mobile and has kind of exploded in the Chinese market. But they have a character who's a skier in the game, as you would expect in a game called Ski Safari. And you can get a power-up in the game, which is you're riding a wolf in the game. And so they changed it to a rocket for the Chinese market. It was a rocket and then also a llama, I think, which I guess is worked. It was good for the Chinese market. They thought it was a good idea. for us, they took our characters and they brought much more of a social aspect to it. So something that's very big in the Chinese market is being able to share your scores and talk with your friends during the game. We didn't have a framework for doing that, but Yoda One did, and they put that into our game, and it has helped activity.
So it's more than just the translation. You're actually
absolutely
making some structural changes to the game.
Absolutely, it has to be, yeah.
And that's probably something that you have the opportunity to do, but maybe it's a little bit more difficult in the film TV space.
It can be. I mean, there's a pretty big trend. It's been going on for a while now, but format rights. And I'll use a pretty commercial example, but the Showtime series Homeland was based on a very popular scripted show in Israel that U.S.-based producers bought those format rights and adapted it for the U.S. market. And that's happening all over the place, you know, and it goes both from Canada, U.S., abroad, and then we'll be, right now, Scandinavia is very hot. Everybody's sort of going into the Scandinavian market and looking at the scripted shows that have been performing well in that space and localizing them here and making them a little bit more relevant to North America. That usually comes down to basically character and that kind of thing, mm-hmm. but... I don't think quite as maybe prohibitive as not having sort of the infrastructure to, as in the gaming space, but.
Okay, great. Other questions? We have a mic right here. There's a question over here as well. We'll have to get you a mic. We've got one right here. We're going to take this question and then we'll head over here.
Hello. Hello, my name is Zifred. It's a question for Ryan. You were talking about selling to international markets and the little differences and everything. But before you sell, how do you find your first audiences to be able to justify these selling arguments? Like, how do you market it to international markets? For the new shows, I mean.
I guess, thankfully, in TV, a lot of trends become somewhat global. So if there's something that's working well in the US and Canada, that oftentimes will translate to a lot of the major markets. So as I said, when we're developing concepts, I'm bringing information from the international market, working with my production colleagues here in Canada, know what the Canadian broadcasters want, and we do our best to try and end up with a show that's going to travel. That's on the TV side. On the digital side, the shows that we come out of Smoke Bomb, we use a lot of social media in order to seed the audience even prior to production. So we just did a show called State of Sin. It's a sci-fi scripted show. We were lucky enough to cast two relatively known sci-fi actors that had huge followings on Twitter and Facebook that were able to sort of rally the audience or the sci-fi audience and their following prior to us even going to camera. So that's something that's a little bit more applicable, I think, when you're producing in the digital space, a little bit more so than in TV, but something that's proven to be pretty successful for us in terms of digital.
So it's mainly social media?
Largely in terms of what we're doing, yeah.
And if there was no social media, how would you do it?
How would we market our TV shows?
Yeah.
I spend an awful lot of time on airplanes and going to conferences and that kind of thing, meeting with broadcasters. And I know, having done this for 10 years, that the best way to sell a show into Asia versus the best way to sell a show into the Middle East. And a lot of that will come down to cultural differences and sensitivities and that kind of stuff. I will have shows that I won't even show to certain broadcasters because I know that it's just not going to be relevant and it's not going to translate to their audience. So I guess that just comes down to market experience and intelligence.
Great. Thank you. I promise we take one more question. Can we do one more over here? And a quick question, and we'll have quick answers. I promise, Raina.
I'm Ming from Doozy Entertainment. We're a mobile game development startup. I have a question for Robart. So I know that in the mobile game industry that the mobile game is becoming more and more saturated and the advertisement cost per user is keeping going up. I wonder that what are the marketing channels you have used that you found it effective? And also that how do you suggest we can collaborate with OMDC to market our game to the market?
Yeah, it's becoming like increasingly difficult to market and get noticed absolutely on mobile. We're struggling with that as well. The simple answer, which I know is not good, is basically know somebody at Apple, which is really hard to do because they're like the Wizard of Oz.
And yes, they are.
You can't like call up someone there and be like, hey, can I talk to someone about my game to get noticed? It's really hard. One good possibility is, and again, it sounds kind of dire when I say it, but Apple's development conference, they have here, WWDC, is really good for that. Sadly, it's really hard to get tickets for that conference, but it's basically all of Apple shuts down. They move into the conference center in San Francisco, the Moscone Center, and it's basically like Apple is there. You get access to all their engineers, their like App Store editorial team. The tickets are crazy expensive. It's $1,600, but it's basically an open door to everyone at Apple. So that's a really good one. The same kind of in Google. We don't have as much of a presence there, but you know, they are a bit more receiving, but it's the same kind of thing. It can be hard to know someone there. But if you get involved, I would say in the industry, eventually you just meet people. You know, meet people locally, go to the big conferences for gaming. GDC is really good. Again, WWDC is really good. There's some smaller ones like 360 iDev, where a lot of people making games are gonna be there, and they have the same problems as you. It's really good to get that insight. That's kind of the short answer I would give. There's obviously innumerable possibilities, but if you can find me after the talk, I'd be happy to talk about that more.
Great. And I'm gonna take the second question, because I can't believe how perfectly this has worked out, because my final comments were going to be about how you can work with OMDC. So thank you very much. That was not a plant. And just to Rob's point about Apple being like the Wizard of Oz, seriously, they are. We have tried. We do numerous events in gaming conferences, and we have begged them to show up. We actually did get them to show up at a conference that we did. We hosted a dinner for participants in one of our programs, and they did show up, and that was a huge success for us, which was great. So, and further to that, working with OMDC and the things that we can do for you and how we can help you, there are a number of programs that you can access, some of which have deadlines coming up. In the interactive digital media, film, TV, and book industries, we have our export fund, and we have deadlines coming up very shortly. IDM deadline is on May the 26th. We will help you get to markets, and we do sometimes have strategic support programs where we'll do a dinner or a networking reception, and sometimes we get Apple to show up. And that's, again, the IDM on May the 26th. Film and TV, we have a deadline on May the 30th. The book industry, there's a deadline on June the 11th. And then in the magazine space, we have our magazine fund on July the 10th. It isn't specifically for export, but Peter and I were speaking earlier, and he has gotten support and did get support, as he mentioned, to enter the U.S. market with his publication and with the launch there. So thank you for the fabulous question, perfectly timed. And with that said, I'd like to thank our panelists for joining us this morning, and I'd like to thank all of you for coming out as well. So we'll be sticking around if you have any questions. And thanks very much. Have a great day, guys.